It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Does age matter in this year's presidential election? The frontrunners in each party, Donald Trump and Joe Biden, are 77 and 81 years old, respectively. Either would be the oldest serving president ever by the end of a four-year term. Since the special counsel report on President Biden's handling of classified documents earlier this month, the current president's age and memory have been in the headlines. Both parties are running excerpts of speeches by the opposing candidate claiming they show signs of decline. And Republican Nikki Haley's campaign has described both of them as grumpy old men. We're taking a look at age as a campaign issue and how we talk about age as a campaign issue. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you concerned about Biden's age, Trump's age, both or neither? Would you like to see younger presidential candidates or different candidates altogether? And hey, if you're over, say, 70-ish, are you offended by some of these arguments we're having about age? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Allison Prash is an associate professor in the Department of Communication Arts at UW-Madison, where she researches U.S. presidential rhetoric, politics, and culture. Allison, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
I can think of one time in my lifetime where it seemed like age was kind of a concern in a presidential race. What kind of precedent do we have for talking about the age of the president?
Well, you know, I think historically in our most recent memory, we could look at the campaign of Ronald Reagan in 1984. There were concerns that were raised about his age, but also Reagan famously would quip that he wasn't going to make his opponent's youth and inexperience a key part of his campaign strategy or a concern. And so I think, you know, with Biden and Trump, as you noted in your introduction, both individuals would be the oldest serving president in U.S. history. So I'd also think it reflects not just a concern about age, but also fitness for office and the ability to do the job.
The media has certainly been talking about this as an issue. What do we know, to the extent that we pull on these things, what do we know about what voters are thinking about this?
Well, so we know a couple things. Number one, you may remember the New York Times Siena College poll that was taken last November, December, and they found that 73% of individuals polled in six of the key swing states, Wisconsin included, were very concerned about Biden's age. They said he was too old to be president. That was a lower number for Trump, for example. But more broadly, when you look at the electorate and what they say about what they expect, not just in presidents, but in individuals who are serving in Washington as politicians, there was a recent Pew survey that talked about that 82% of Republicans and 79% of Democrats support an age limit. So this is a concern that extends beyond the chief executive and also to members of Congress.
This is kind of a touchy subject. There are people in this age range listening right now, I am sure, who might think, well, I could, you know, do jobs just as well as I used to. Can you talk a little bit about how we could talk about this issue without casting aspersions on a large and growing cohort of Americans?
Yeah, I think it's a really important thing to discuss because I would argue that when we bring up the issue of age or the factor of age, it's not necessarily just a number. We're not just talking about being 81 or being 77, but it really is a conversation about the ability to do the job. And I think first and foremost, it's important to remember that we're talking about the president of the United States, the most powerful job in the world. And I mean that in a sense that, you know, this is the individual whose decisions can have impact on countless lives, right? Nuclear codes, et cetera. So I think, first of all, we need to consider the fact that we're talking about the job or the role of the president. I think, number two, we need to recognize that it's a conversation about not just fitness, but also what we perceive of the presidency. So the presidency is not just about the decisions that are made, but also the image that is projected. And so I think some of the concern or discussions around this issue is less about whether Biden is 81, for example, or is he able to do the job? What are some of the concerns that people are seeing with various slips that he has made? And also more broadly, what does it project about the image of the presidency that we've come to expect?
In some ways, I feel like we're turning into amateur gerontologists here where, you know, Republicans might run a video. Here's Biden confusing the presidents of Mexico and Egypt. Democrats run a video, and Nikki Haley does too, of Donald Trump confusing Nikki Haley and Nancy Pelosi. You can make a case that if you went back and got Biden and Trump videos from 20, 40 years ago, they both say unusual things in unusual ways sometimes. How can we, watching them in their, when we encounter them, when they're speaking, how are we making these judgments?
Yeah. I mean, I think there was a really interesting op-ed in the New York Times a few weeks ago that was talking about how we can understand the decisions that we all make. I've done this in class in front of my students of mixed up speakers, right? It's something that happens to all of us in particular ways. I think the important thing to note, perhaps, is that it's not just about age and it's not just about capacity or fitness for office, but it also, I think, is reflecting a deeper angst among a wide majority of the electorate, regardless of political party, that they don't see themselves reflected in these two candidates. So, for example, this concern about whether someone who is 81 or 77 is as concerned about the issue of climate change or reproductive justice, for example, as the students that sit in my class every Tuesday and Thursday. And so it's this concern that, does this individual really fully understand and appreciate the concerns that are facing me in my individual lives and experiences and what that means for the rest of my life?
Talking to Allison Prash from UW-Madison's Communication Arts Department, talking about age, mental ability, and passing the torch in politics with old candidates, older candidates for president here in the United States, pretty old Congress as well. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you thinking about age as an issue? How are you thinking about age as an issue in politics? Join in at 800-642-1234. I want to pick up that generational point you mentioned, Allison, and you actually suggested a clip here that we're going to listen to from the musical Hamilton, the song One Last Time. We've got George Washington, played by Christopher Jackson, talking to Alexander Hamilton, played by Lin-Manuel Miranda, to help him write his farewell address.
Mr. President, they will say you're weak.
No, they will see we're strong.
Your position is so unique.
So I'll use it to move them along.
Why do you have to say goodbye?
If I say goodbye, the nation learns to move on. It outlives me when I'm gone.
Not specifically about age there, but about that idea of deciding when it's time to be done and let a new generation take over. How does that fit into how you're looking at the 2024 election?
Well, I think it's important to note, first of all, that when Washington made the decision to move on, to cede his political power, this was not a constitutionally mandated thing that he needed to do. It's not until 1951, for example, that it is actually enshrined in the Constitution that there are just two terms. And it, in fact, is a precedent that every president follows until FDR. And so Washington's decision to step aside for the larger good of the country is seen by various individuals in both political parties at the time as this really radical act of embodying the spirit of democracy. I think it's also interesting to note, historian Ron Chernow talks about in his biography of Washington, that this decision elevates Washington's moral standard around the world, and it even is praised by King George. Yes, that King George. And so I think it's a testament to how Washington saw himself as a custodian of the institution of the presidency, and then was ready to pass that on, that it was not his to own. And I think that's a really fundamental thing to keep in mind as we think about today.
So when people are talking about age and mental capacity, they may be thinking about those things in particular, but could they also be seeing, it seems like you're saying this as a proxy for, hey, maybe we're ready for these politicians to move on?
Yes. And in fact, some of the angst that you hear expressed, I think, most prominently within Democrats who are concerned about Biden, for example, is they will say, hey, in 2020, he ran and he promised that he was going to be this transitional candidate, that he was going to provide a bridge to help us get out of Trump, COVID, et cetera. And now the concern for them is saying, well, what about a new generation of leadership and this idea that perhaps Biden, you know, can hold on to the presidency because it's his? Now, you can make a similar argument about Trump, you know, because there are various Republicans who are really frustrated with that he has become the brand of conservatism. That's what one of Haley's challenges to him, right? But there are also Republicans who really like that brand. And so I think it goes on both sides.
And is there a general frustration, do you think, with the whole Biden-Trump rematch concept in the first place? It seems like a lot of people are a little unexcited by that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't think you could say people were excited in 2020 about that matchup. And so in 2024, we are dealing with the same old, quite literally. And so there's this concern amongst people. They're not necessarily apathetic. It's not that they don't care. But at least from the people that I've talked to and the polling data I've read, it's a general dissatisfaction that these are our two best options. And how is that the case in this current moment?
You also pointed us toward an interesting point that We had President Trump as a candidate saying, only I can save you. Only I can fix the country. We have President Biden saying, in effect, I think, only I can save us from Donald Trump. That's a different vision, the individual vision of a president versus maybe what we should be thinking of as a president.
It is. And, you know, I think it's an interesting point that I think we should all consider of thinking about if Biden's true argument is to say that Donald Trump, in his belief, is such a threat to American democracy and that only I can save you or I'm the best person and best equipped to run to defeat him. That also tells us something about ourselves of why is that the case. Now, I think Biden was the right candidate for Democrats in 2020 for a number or a host of reasons, and that's what they decided, right? But in both instances, both individuals, I think, are in some way clinging to their hold on their party, whether for Trump it's this belief that I am the Republican Party, or whether it's for Biden that I alone can save you from this threat on the outside. And I think that, you know, like Washington did, there could be a vision or a view of statespersonship, I should say, that says I want to develop this next generation of political leadership. We're not devoid of it, but it has been exclusive when you have these two individuals who so personify both sides of the political spectrum. And that's a problem as we think about going forward of who is that next generation of leadership going to be and how are they developed and cultivated and who is gatekeeping to a certain extent.
Allison Prash is with us, associate professor in the Department of Communication Arts at UW-Madison, where she researches U.S. presidential rhetoric, politics, and culture. She's with us for a look at the current debate around the age of presidential candidates and why this might be more than just age we're talking about. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Love to hear from our younger and older listeners in particular. If you are a younger voter, you can define younger however you want. Are you frustrated by a lock on these leadership positions of a couple few generations ahead of you? If you're an older voter, are you frustrated with how we're talking about these older candidates? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with UW-Madison professor Allison Prash about what's at stake when it comes to the age of presidential candidates and other elected officials. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Terry is with us in Manawa. Terry, hi.
Hi. Last election cycle, Trump said Biden was too old to run at that time. Now Trump is that age. What changed?
Allison, what do you think?
That's a great question. Well, I mean, I think you have to consider two things. First of all, Trump isn't necessarily always aware of the things that he's previously said and holding himself to that standard. So I think part of it may be, you know, not having that hindsight and also wanting to portray his opponent in particular ways. You know, I'll also say in answer to your question, I think one of the things that is different this time around is that the public has had 4 years to watch Biden age every day on our television screens and on our phones. We see that various elements of decline, quite frankly, as he has changed over the last 4 years. We don't have that up close and personal view of Trump on a daily basis. We see him in court defending himself in various, legal issues, but we've seen Biden slowly decline in particular ways. And so I think that public perception of age for Biden has shifted the tone in a bit.
Thanks for the call, Terry. Daryl is with us in Menominee Falls. Daryl, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to, there was just a discussion or a point brought up about the two gatekeepers, which would be the best gatekeeper for the two parties. And no matter the age of Joe Biden, he has far more experience and knowledge about how the country works, how politics works. And Donald Trump is not for this country. He represents all his own interests, and he would be the worst gatekeeper for the next generation of politicians. If he's the example of the Republican Party, my gosh, that party's in trouble.
Daryl, thanks a lot for the call. Faced with a choice between two older candidates, people will find ways to choose between them, Allison.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, your comment gets to the fact that we're talking about age, and it's not just about ability, but it's also about competence or judgment or experience. And this idea that one of the benefits of having, you know, longer time in public office and public life is being able to make those hard choices and those judgments. And so I think that's something to definitely keep in mind.
Thanks for that call. Joy joins us now from West Bend. Joy, hello.
Hi. I am an older voter, but progressive. And I've heard from people for my whole life that the pendulum swings back and forth. You know, we're going to get a progressive candidate sometime. But as far as I'm concerned, we haven't. I will vote for Joe, but I do see him as looking unsteady when he walks. You know, his hair is thin. He doesn't seem so presentable. Neither does Trump. I would like to see a more progressive candidate. Joe Biden is a corporate Democrat. He's in the good old boys club. He may have more experience, but as far as I'm concerned, he's not pushing for the progressive issues as Bernie, for instance. Bernie is older. I would vote for him because he has more energy and more experience to, you know, communicate the
progressive. Joy, thanks a lot for the call. Allison, what do you think of what you hear from Joy there?
Well, Joy, I think one of the things that you're articulating is a concern about particular issues or values key identity markers of particular groups of people. And those transcend age, right? There are concerns, as you noted, particular progressive issues. That's not just a concern of someone's age, but also, younger voters, older voters, et cetera. And so I think faced with this choice that we have in 2024, I think that's what voters are going to need to do is kind of make some calculated decisions of, okay, we have these two candidates. They are these more advanced ages. And so then what can I benefit or why do I support their policies in particular ways?
Thanks for the call, Joy. Talking to Allison Prash, UW-Madison Communication Arts Professor, looking at age and perception of age in the presidential race this year. Jim joins us now in Juneau. Jim, hello.
I didn't take this. Hold on.
Yes. Hello.
Go ahead, Jim. You're on the air.
So, I'm kind of disillusioned with our our parties at this point. I mean, we're not being given any real choices anymore. You got Biden, who obviously has age-related issues. His mental capacity is slipping as far as his ability to communicate, and that worries me about where he's going with everything else. And as far as the Republican Party goes, I mean, what are they sending at us? A businessman. This is the leader of our country, and we're the last thing you want sitting in that seat is somebody whose mind has been geared towards making a profit for themselves.
Gotcha, Jim. Thanks a lot for the call. I don't know that. Certainly, in the 2016 election leading up to it, the Republican Party, the establishment, didn't want it to end up being Donald Trump. I don't know that Democrats were really enthusiastic about Joe Biden as the standard bearer this year. How much do political parties control their standard bearer in a presidential race anymore?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. You know, I think in the case of 2024, one of the factors is the fact that if you are the incumbent president, if you are the sitting president, you are the de facto leader of your political party. And so there was a lot of angst amongst Democrats, for example, that, you know, the Biden administration or people in Biden world, there were reports of, you know, really making sure that there wasn't an active primary challenger because Biden was going to run again. That's not unique to Biden, to be clear. I mean, this is the case regardless of political party when you are the incumbent president. But I understand that this caller's frustration on both sides, right, that it does seem like it's held or determined in particular ways that I think a lot of people are frustrated by.
Thanks for that call. I want to take a couple minutes to talk about, you have access to a group of voters, college students in particular. What kind of things are you hearing from them as they talk about Biden and Trump and age and generational cohorts?
It's a great question. And I have been talking with them about the 2024 election. For the last few semesters in 2020, I taught a class on the rhetoric of the presidential election. I'll be doing the same type of class this fall. And one of the things that has stuck out to me over the last year is that in general, the students that I interact with talk about that they feel very disillusioned and very dispassionate about not just both candidates, but how they understand their own political identity in relationship to the election. It's always helpful for me to think about that if my college students sitting in my classroom are 18 to 22, it means that their political memory is quite short, that they have been exposed to Biden, to Trump. Perhaps they remember Obama, perhaps. And so if you think about how you understand your political identity, and if you think about the last 8 years, it has been very partisan and very polarizing, and we live through a global pandemic. And so those are some of the questions that are in voters' minds, and they don't see a candidate who is articulating their concerns as much as they'd like to.
Would you, a little bit of time for a big question here. Would you like to see Biden and Trump both step out of this race, open the door to another generation? It won't happen, but
won't
open
happen.
The door to another generation.
It won't happen. And there are, you know, clear logistical hurdles. If I could go back a year and a half ago, absolutely. I think that it would be a meaningful demonstration on both sides of what it might look like to uphold the institution of the presidency as something that is rooted in the Constitution that extends beyond one individual. I think that it's really important that one of the things that George Washington does in his farewell address is he embodies this idea of a transition of power. That is one of the things that distinguishes our Constitution and our system of government. It's something that we should prize. And so I think that there's no better way to support that and embody that than to be willing to cede power to recognize what needs to come after you for the health and good of the nation.
Allison, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Allison Prash is an associate professor in the Department of Communication Arts at UW-Madison, where she researches U.S. presidential rhetoric, politics, and culture. Been talking about the recent public debates around aging and the presidency, as both of this year's presidential frontrunners have faced questions about their age during the campaign. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A rule in the works from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid would set a minimum standard for nursing staff at nursing home facilities, the ones that participate in Medicare and Medicaid, anyway. Understaffing and staff turnover has been a chronic problem in the senior care industry. And on top of that, our next guest says the industry could use more significant changes than just more staffing to meet the current need for nursing home services. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a connection to a nursing home in Wisconsin? Do you live in one yourself? Have a friend or loved one who does? How is the level of care? Does it feel like there's enough staff, nursing in particular? And if you work or have worked in a facility like this, what do things look like from your perspective? Are there efforts underway to increase staffing? Do you see a lot of turnover in staff? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Barbara Bowers is Professor Emerita at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Nursing. Barb, welcome to Central Time.
Great. Glad to be here.
You've done a lot of research on this. You've talked to people who work at facilities. You've done focus groups with residents. Seems like everybody agrees that there's not enough staff to go around. Is that right?
I think that's pretty universal. It'd be very difficult to find someone who, especially people who live there or work there, to say that there was enough staff.
What is driving that shortage?
Actually, several things. For one thing, there's a very high turnover rate. The turnover rate for the direct caregivers who are certified nursing assistants, CNAs, is over 100% in a lot of facilities, but the average for the U.S. is about 80% annually. So that's a huge loss of people. So even if you recruit a lot, if you're losing them out the other end, you're not going to have you're not going to be able to retain a good level of staff. There's also, if you just look at age demographics, the number of people who are younger, and most of the CNAs are younger. It's a job that people often get out of high school. So if you have the ratio of younger people to people who are aging and needing long-term care is declining. So we have fewer and fewer people available to become caregivers. And then I think the third thing is probably what's going on with immigration. In the past, we've been able to sort of fast track CNAs and nurses from other countries. And there's a big debate about whether or not that's an ethical thing to do, sort of poaching people from countries who, quote, taking their staff who they really need for their own population. But that aside, probably about 30% of CNAs in the country were born somewhere outside the United States. So those three things happening all at the same time, I think, is leading to a real crisis.
Now, that rule I mentioned from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, trying to set at least minimum standards, set new minimum standards for nursing staff. This is still in the works. It's not a done deal yet. What strikes you about this effort to have this rule passed?
It's very contentious. I think the nursing home industry providers are always wary of mandates. I think one of the biggest thing they're worried about is because of the lack of availability of people to work in nursing homes, they're concerned that a staffing mandate would be impossible to implement. I think that's a big worry. The other worry is that more staff means more expense. And so there are a lot of people in the industry who are saying there's not enough money to actually pay staff, pay additional staff. And pay level has been an issue for a long time. The pandemic, actually, because there was such a shortage, allowed nursing home workers to actually get pay increases. They are traditionally about 75 to 80% of what you would get paid if you worked in a hospital. So the pay has been an issue for a while. And certainly one of the reasons why it's hard to recruit and retain staff.
Barbara Bowers is with us from the UW-Madison School of Nursing, looking at low staffing levels, just not enough workers to go around to provide nursing staff at nursing homes. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Eric joins us now in Cedarburg. Eric, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Great topic. My grandmother spent the last 15 years or so in a nursing home in Milwaukee, and she just passed away, unfortunately, at 102, which was amazing in the first place. But but I have to say that the staff, well, first of all, underemployment of staff at these facilities is just tragic. And the people that are sticking it out, that are working there, they're so overworked, they're so underappreciated, and you know, mandates, you know, that's a difficult subject, but people need to realize that these are your loved ones that are being taken care of, and there needs to be so much more attention. I'm so glad for your program today, and just kudos to all of the people that are working there, that are working long hours and really underappreciated with very difficult situations. And I just wanted to make that comment so that maybe the public can really start thinking hard about where funding needs to be applied. So that
Eric, thanks a lot for the call. And Eric references, you know, the people who stick it out and stay in these nursing home jobs, maybe under difficult conditions, amid lots of turnover. Let's get into that, Barbara. You've done a lot of work on what can make better working conditions. It is not just a numbers game, not just more staff, but how staff are deployed and treated. Could you share some of what you found?
Yeah, to follow up on something that Eric just said, I think they're probably not underappreciated, but you know, when you put a loved member of your family in a nursing home and they have to wait a long time for even just basic things to be taken to the toilet or to, if someone's in pain, to get pain medication, families get really upset, and their frustration, I think, gets taken out on the staff, even though families do generally really appreciate the staff who are taking care of them. So this is I think it's a really tough situation. So that's one thing that contributes. Another thing is these workers often can't make ends meet on one job. So a huge number of nursing home workers actually work two jobs. This was an issue during the pandemic because you had workers who were going from one nursing home to another and spreading COVID by doing it. So they weren't able to kind of keep into to stay with one institution, and which is a great way to prevent spreading the virus. So the fact that they can't make ends meet with one job, working two jobs, often they are the caregivers for extended families. They're seen as people with the knowledge and the experience to help out others. So those are some of the external things. And internally, I think there's a real issue with the way most nursing homes organize their care. People tend to not, the staff tends to not work in teams. They work very individually. Part of that is driven by the low levels of staffing, so that people are just focused on the tasks they have to do and don't really have time to create cohesive teams, back each other up. They don't have time to go to continuing education. There is very little continuing education provided for nursing home staff. They have requirements. For example, you have to learn infection control, use of fire extinguishers are some things that are mandated by the state. But actually, a sense of building a career by learning more, developing knowledge, most CNAs in particular don't have that experience. There's no career ladder. There's nowhere to go. Now, some nursing homes have actually changed that, where they have created some career ladders for CNAs. But in general, that's it. You take a CNA job, and that's kind of that's the end of it. There's no place to advance or to be promoted. I think also one of the things I'll say about the nursing staff who supervise the CNAs is they often are not trained or experienced, skilled in supervising. So many nurses I've talked to, when I talk to them about their role as a supervisor of CNAs, they talk about discipline and making sure that people do things right, instead of really acting as a mentor. And I worked, did a study in the greenhouse homes, which has set up a very strong mentoring relationship between the nurses and the CNAs. And it works beautifully, with everybody feeling like the care is better, there's room for advancement. And even if you don't have a new specific position, one of the things you do get is a sense that you are developing as a professional. So I think, I mean, those are some of the other things that we really need to change.
Thanks.
And there's social stigma as well. People are sometimes embarrassed to say they work in a nursing home because of the response they get from people who haven't really spent any time inside a nursing home.
Thanks for that call, Eric. We're talking about challenges facing nursing home facilities in Wisconsin, including but not limited to chronic understaffing. Barbara Bauer stays with us, Professor Emerita at the UW-Madison School of Nursing. A new proposed federal requirement for facilities that participate in Medicare and Medicaid would call for increased nursing staff. Our guest says more changes are needed, too. You could join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Barbara Bowers, Professor Emerita at the UW-Madison School of Nursing, looking at staffing shortages in nursing homes and other problems that lead to high turnover among staff at nursing homes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Jonah is with us in Green Bay. Jonah, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah, what'd you want to tell us about, Jonah?
So my grandpa on my dad's side died less than a month ago. We actually just had the funeral on Monday. He and my grandma, my dad's mom, have both been in and out of the, or were in and out of the nursing home system quite a lot in their final years. And I got to see that personally. And I personally got to see a lot of the, you know, issues of being understaffed, or especially just workers clearly being fried out of their minds. Like, they can't even put much less the physical energy, but the emotional energy necessary to take care of elders just wasn't there. And I don't know, it's just become a very personal issue for me.
Jonah, I'm sorry about those difficulties and for your loss. Thank you for calling in. Barbara, I'm sure Jonah is not alone in that observation.
Right. One of the things I've observed and heard residents say is the more short-staffed a facility is, the more frazzled the staff gets, the more short-tempered. Clearly, the care declines when people are pushed emotionally and physically. It reminds me of a study I did a long time ago where I was talking to CNAs who had left, was doing interviews with people who had actually left an organization. And one of the things they told me was that when you go to work every day and you really want to do something good, and people take these jobs because they care. I mean, they're not well paid. It's tough work. So it's a special kind of person who gravitates to a job like this, but they get so burned out. And what I heard from them was when they are in a position when they can no longer provide the care they know people need, that's one of the things that actually drives people out. They see themselves doing things that they don't approve of. They don't like watching themselves work.
Thank you for sharing that with us, Jonah. Brooke joins us now in Eau Claire. Brooke, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
I'm actually a hospice aide. I'm currently going to school right now for nursing. I have the pleasure of going to people's homes, nursing homes. We go absolutely everywhere, wherever our hospice patients are. I have been working with hospice for over 2 years, and like with after COVID, we've had a lot of travel agencies come into our nursing homes, CNAs to nurses, and I feel like a lot of facilities now, because they can't get people to come into work, they're paying so much for these travel companies to come in and work for them. The quality of care is actually going down. The workers feel like they're not being compensated like they should be. With Barbara mentioning the career ladders, I feel like every facility should do that, and we should be implementing high school students to come in and try. It's a community. Nursing homes are communities. We need to have kids and families see that, like, this is a part of our community. And when I was in high school, I actually did the CNA work to school program, and I haven't left healthcare since.
Brooke, thank you so much for sharing that story. So much there, Barb, we can talk about. First of all, Brooke referring to traveling nurses who can make pretty good money, I think, but are a stopgap. Is that something that's affecting nursing homes?
Yeah, it is. And for a long time, in order to fill the short staffing, nursing homes have used agencies, which are not, it's sort of the same in that they are not permanent members of the organization. They are access through an agency. They don't travel around the country like travel nurses do, although there certainly are some travel nurses now in long-term care. But for years, agency nurses have been a significant part of the nursing home workforce. And Brooke is right in that they are not familiar with the staff. They're not familiar with how the organization operates. They don't know the physicians. They don't know the family members. One of the most important things in quality of care and quality of life, which is a really important issue. I mean, when that's where you live, it's not just the technical care that you receive. It's the whole ambiance and the feeling of being part of a community. And that's impossible to maintain when the people in that community are constantly churning, coming and going. One of the most important quality of life factors is what's referred to as continuity of staff or consistency of staff, consistent assignment of the same person to the same resident in a community where you get to know the person, they feel like a friend to you, they understand the little things that make your day better. And that is just completely gone when you have to use a lot of agency or travel nurses. So I agree with what Brooke has said. But if there's this is one of the things that I know organizations are afraid of, with a staffing mandate level, more and more agency nurses might be required. And also, as she said, they cost 2, 3, 4 times more than regular staff do. So it's a huge issue.
Thanks for that call, Brooke. Karen is with us in Osceola. Karen, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Rob. I couldn't agree. I'm an RN and have been for years. I couldn't agree with your guest and the previous caller, Brooke, more. this is multifactorial, but one thing, as far as legislature, we've got to reimburse for Medicaid patients better. These places can't survive when the reimbursement rate is so poor. And it's the nursing homes, they can't survive. So, and why don't we treat people who do this kind of work, if someone's gone to law school, maybe we need to, anytime I meet a CNA and that you ask somebody what they do, I'm always like, God love you. Thank you so much. Your work is really hard and we need more people like you. I mean, we have to elevate their status in our society. I don't quite know how to do that, but I mean, this is really hard work and it's a tough problem.
Karen, thanks for the call. I think to Karen's first point, Barb, I think I heard you nodding along when it came to Medicaid reimbursements.
Yeah, this is a really interesting issue. As part of that CMS bill, the rule that they're proposing in terms of mandated staffing levels, there's another section that talks about transparency in organizations. So there's a lot of controversy right now about where does this money actually go that organizations are getting. And so there's a lot of concern that money isn't going to the staff, but there's significant profits to be made in these organizations. And so that's something that CMS is planning to look at a little more closely. And I think that's going to be a really important thing to look at, how much money is being taken out of the organization for profit as opposed to increasing the pay or benefits of the staff there. And Medicaid is a particularly low payer. And one of the things we know from a lot of research is that the more Medicaid residents you have, more people who are supported by Medicaid funding, which is, as I said, is lower than Medicare and lower than private pay, the worse the outcomes are and the higher the staff turnover and the lower the staffing. So it all kind of goes together. But I think it'll be really interesting to have a look at where the money is actually going. And then, I mean, that's important information to have in determining what the level should actually be. One of the things that, with all these things we've talked about that increase the payouts, whether it's agency nurses or turnover, costs thousands of dollars per person every year. The advertising, the orientation, the lower level of productivity in terms of new staff who are just getting used to the facility, all of these things continue to increase the costs of nursing home care. So it's a really a perfect storm with probably, I would agree with the caller that there isn't enough money going to support Medicaid residents, and this translates into less positive outcomes for the residents. But I think we need more information about what's happening with funds before we make decisions about how much more needs to be put into nursing homes.
Thanks, Karen. On a related note, just about out of time, Barb, but a caller is wondering, she says a local small town, locally owned nursing home is now owned by an out-of-state company. I've seen articles about private equity firms buying in. Briefly, is that a big deal?
Well, again, it's controversial. I think it's a big deal. I think, you know, these private equity firms are not in the business of providing healthcare, quality of life, care for older adults. They're basically real estate companies. And I think this is a huge problem that someone who's focused on, this is not real estate. This is care of people, support for staff. So I'm sure there are people out there who disagree with me, but I'm very uncomfortable about these organizations getting involved.
Barb, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today. Mm-hmm. That's Barbara Bowers, Professor Emerita at the UW-Madison School of Nursing. We talked to her today about challenges facing nursing home providers in Wisconsin as the industry looks at new federally proposed minimum standards for staffing and a shortfall in staffing facing pretty much the whole industry. Still time for you to share your story. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up later this month, hey, imagine a winter member drive with only one day of interruptions to your favorite Wisconsin public radio programs. That sounds pretty good, right? Well, that is our plan this time around, but we're going to need your help to make it happen. We still have to raise the same amount of money as a 7-day drive. You can help us reach that goal with your gift right now. Plus, now is a great time to give. When 500 people donate before February 28th, an extra $20,000 will be unlocked for the news, conversations, and music you value. You can give right now. Do it online at WPR.org/donate. And thanks so much. Do you want to live on Mars? Now's your chance. No space travel required. As reported by NPR, NASA is looking for applications for people to live in a Mars habitat simulator. Starting next year, four participants will live in Mars Dune Alpha, a simulated Mars base at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. According to a release from NASA, crew tasks will include simulated spacewalks, robotic operations, habitat maintenance, exercise, and crop growth, and dealing with problems like resource limits, equipment failures, communication delays, and other environmental stressors. Interested? It's a one-year commitment. They're looking for non-smoking 30 to 55-year-olds with interest and lots of experience in science, technology, engineering, and math. The pay? You find out during the application process. The deadline for applications is April 2nd. I'm not really good at science stuff, but I could be the first host for Mars Public Radio. Give me a call, NASA. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, a bill in the state legislature would create tax credits to help keep video game companies and their employees in Wisconsin. We'll learn more about the proposal and the impact of the game development industry here in the state. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's former executive producer Erica Janik with a story about a civil rights icon who lives here in Wisconsin.
Gwen Gillen now calls Madison home, but her roots are in the South, where she fought for civil rights. Jeff Burkhardt brings us her story.
Civil rights leader Stokely Carmichael called her a gutsy little sister. At 17, Gwen Gillen became the youngest staff member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Now, the retired teacher calls Madison home, but she grew up in Anniston, Alabama, one of seven children.
My first memory is that three-room shack, and oftentimes when you see old movies of the South and the slave huts, you see these three-room shacks where we didn't have electricity. We had candle lights at night, and there was no refrigerator, and the ice man used to come around. So we pretty much had the same meal every day until I graduated from high school. We had beans and cornbread.
Later, they moved to Bear Mash at the foot of the Appalachians, where they picked plums and blueberries, and they had electricity and running water. Gwen's mother was one of the people who petitioned the local government for it.
She worked as a maid, but she insisted that we go to school every day. You couldn't make the law C. She wanted a B or an A. During my senior year, I got chosen for a scholarship to go to Tougaloo College in Tougaloo, Mississippi.
It was there at Tougaloo College in 1963 that she met members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
When I got to Tougaloo, I met the civil rights people, and I asked them, well, how can I be a part of the movement? And they said, well, you can join us. And so I dropped out of Tougaloo College in about 2 weeks after being there and joined the civil rights movement and became a staff member of SNCC.
Gwen later went to Oberlin College in preparation for the Freedom Summer of 1964.
We weren't making any progress, so to speak, just sitting in at lunch counters and stuff like that. So we thought the best thing to do was to register people to vote.
On the first day of Freedom Summer, June 21st, 1964, three young civil rights workers were murdered. They, like Gwen, had been registering black voters in Mississippi. The men were arrested by the police on trumped-up charges and then released after dark into the hands of the Ku Klux Klan.
We went hunting for them in Neshoba County, and we would go in at night in black clothing and walk around the bushes and stuff and see if we could find them. I think they found them about a week or two later. It was frightening, but we had to do something.
Gwen continued to work for SNCC for the next 2 years. Then in 1966, she was offered a scholarship to the UW-Madison.
And I personally wanted to understand American history. I was a person, and an American, and I didn't feel I should be treated any different than anybody else. And I just couldn't understand why they did that.
She studied American history as she planned and eventually got a degree in special education. She continued to be active in the civil rights movement on campus and in Milwaukee. Gwen's time fighting for civil rights in Alabama, Mississippi, and Wisconsin helped her understand herself and the importance of political participation.
I learned that you should vote every time. I think that voting matters.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
This is Central Time. When you think of the video game industry, you might think of maybe Silicon Valley in California. But Wisconsin is quietly emerging as a player for game development studios. A bunch of prominent companies have offices around the Madison area. Green Bay recently leveled up with the launch of a new video game company, Midwest Games, that quickly raised $3 million in investments. Wisconsin-based game developers have had a hand in creating big-name games like Call of Duty and PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, a.k.a. PUBG, and industry leaders see the Midwest being even more prominent with the rise in remote work. Some state lawmakers are working to incentivize these video game companies to come to and stay in Wisconsin, with a proposal in the state legislature to create tax credit for wages and other expenses. Republican State Senator Patrick Teston of Stevens Point is a co-author of the bill and said the legislation could help Wisconsin compete with other states for a bigger piece of the pie.
We're seeing a lot of these companies who are currently located in California, which has a much different take on industry and are taxing their citizens to the hilt. And so this is an opportunity for us to capture some of that. And as we're all well aware, demographically, we are in a war for talent between 49 other states. And I think it's incentives like these that will entice developers and employers to come into the state and continue to grow this burgeoning industry right here in Wisconsin.
UW-Stout, UW-Whitewater, and UW-Green Bay all have programs that prepare students for the video game business. Supporters of the bill see this as a way to keep more of those graduates in the state. We're learning more about video games and Wisconsin, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more video game developers here in the state? What do you think of this idea of tax credits to help bring them or keep them here? Do you work in this industry yourself, or do you rely on their products for your entertainment? Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Tim Gerritsen is the Chief Operations Officer for Lost Boys Interactive, a video game development studio based in Madison. Tim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
And Andrew Williams is a professor of art and design history at UW-Stout, where he researches interactive media and digital games. Andrew, thanks for being with us.
Yes, great to be here.
Andrew, as I mentioned, it might be under the radar for a lot of people. How big is the video game and digital interactive media industry here in the state?
It's very well established, and we actually have quite a history of game development within the state, from all the way from 1974 with Dungeons and Dragons being made in Lake Geneva, all the way through the 1990s with some of the early 3D based games like Wolfenstein 3D and ID, and then how that winds up developing further all the way through. And so we've had a really great long history and been flying under the radar for a number of years, but recently seen a lot of explosion of developers and a lot of interest in our state.
Tim, as someone in the industry, do you feel like Wisconsin's still flying under the radar, viewed from the world video game scene, or are people starting to take notice?
People are definitely starting to take notice. I mean, we do still somewhat fly under the radar a bit, but there's quite a bit of talent that came out of Wisconsin and went out into the industry. People like myself, who are born and raised here, but went out and got a career elsewhere and are, you know, looked to come back and be able to increase the rate of development in our own state. I think a lot of people are starting to take more notice. A lot of really big games are actually created right here in the state right now. And we do compete on a global basis. So Wisconsin is really starting to have an impact, and that impact is growing really over the last 5 years, especially. It has grown quite a bit.
Andrew, I believe you've testified in favor of this idea in the state legislature of giving these incentives to have the video game industry here and the video game workers here in particular. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So as a professor at the University of Wisconsin Stout, you know, we prepare our students for these high-tech based careers, these highly interdisciplinary based careers. And we often see many of them going to other states because for a number of reasons, they may be looking for other areas. And so we want to be able to keep and retain those people right here. And we want to be able to find ways to grow the things that we know that can make our state really impactful and can really expand the future potential. And so, again, we spend a lot of time investing in these students and training them, developing really great relationships. And we want to make sure that the best talent stays here because we've always had the talent in the state.
Tim, why is Lost Boys Interactive here in Madison and not in California or Washington or Austin, Texas, or all the other options out there?
Well, in some ways, we kind of are. We're one of the companies that really embraced remote first. Mm-hmm. So our company is based in Madison. I'm based out of DeForest myself. But we have employees all over the United States. We're actually in 33 different states currently. But Wisconsin's our home base. And the reason we found it here is because Wisconsin has a really unique blend of talent and creativity that you really need to have an effective video game company. I think there are a few places in the country that have that unique blend of creative talent and technical talent that can come together to make games. In the past, that was places like Silicon Valley, but I think Madison, Austin, Texas, Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina, those are sort of the current it places for game development. And it's because of that blend, because games really are interdisciplinary, and we hire writers, we hire technical people, we hire designers, we hire musicians, we hire audio technicians, not to mention just our operations groups who keep everything going. So because of that interdisciplinary nature, it's not just, oh, you're in a tech hub, so that's perfect. It has to be that real blend of creativity and technical talent to be really successful in the industry.
We are talking about the video game industry here in Wisconsin with Lost Boys Interactive COO Tim Gerritsen and UW Stout Art and Design History Professor Andrew Williams. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the video game industry here in Wisconsin? Are you part of it? Do you work in this field? Have you taken classes at UW Stout or other campuses in the state that relate to video game design? What do you think of the idea of tax credits to boost the video game industry and to have some of those remote workers that Tim just mentioned locate here in the state? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about the video game industry here in Wisconsin. Our guests are Tim Gerritsen from the Madison-based game development studio Lost Boys Interactive and Andrew Williams, professor at UW Stout, where they have a program in video game design and development. They're with us today to talk about the variety of game development companies in the state, their impact on the economy, a bill in the state legislature aimed at creating tax credits to keep them here and have their workers here as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have questions about video game creation here in the state. If you've experienced some of these college classes yourself, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Andrew, wanted to ask about the program at UW Stout. What kind of things do students in the program there learn about creating video games?
Yeah, so we have a really unique setup here. We have actually two majors that are in two of the main disciplines that are associated with the process of game development. One is associated with the creation of art and visuals and animation, 3D graphics, and basically anything that you might see. The other program is associated with computer science and the programming part, the parts that allow the driving underneath the hood things. And so our students, as they go through these two programs, work collaboratively together through all 4 years of their experience with us. And by the time they become a senior, they have a full year experience where they're effectively running as their own independent game studio. And at that point, the instructor winds up becoming more like an executive producer role. And so we're trying to help simulate as much as we possibly can within an educational environment, the multidisciplinary nature of game development, because it's very hard to be a completely solo developer because it requires so many different kinds of skills. And the other thing that goes along with that, too, is the really essential soft skills that are developed because you're working collaboratively, resolving conflicts, you're setting up your own management structure. And so all those things are transferable to areas that are also well outside of the area of game development.
And Tim, I wanted to ask, is there a critical mass effect when I think of, you know, technology hubs like Silicon Valley or industry hubs like, you know, Detroit and autos or Wisconsin in the dairy industry? You have universities doing research, churning out students who go into work at that. You have more and more companies going into that in that area. Are we on the verge of something like that in Wisconsin where we have enough where we get that critical mass and more people look at Wisconsin as a place to make video games?
I think we're pretty close to that, if not there already. We have a number of major studios that have either set up shop here or are in the process of setting up shop here. And you do get that. One comparison I would make is in Canada, the video game industry has really risen over the last 15 years. In large part because of these types of tax breaks. If you look at something like the province of Quebec, they went from having really just a few dozen developers to now having something like 25,000 developers in just the province of Quebec. Major companies, when they see these sorts of things, do flock there. And we're a talent-based industry. So when there is a known source of talent, companies do tend to flock to there. And just in the last year, we've seen, you mentioned Midwest Games up in Green Bay. We also have Respawn Entertainment relocated here in Madison, not to mention the several of pre-existing companies that have been growing like crazy over the last decade.
Andrew, one thing I've mentioned a couple times is this isn't just these proposed tax incentives aren't just to have the businesses in Wisconsin, but to have the workers here. As Tim mentioned earlier, this is work. A lot of it you can do remotely. When you talk to students at UW-Stout, do they particularly want to stick around Wisconsin and become video game creators? Or given that they could do it remotely from anywhere, do they care where they end up living?
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of the students that we have are native to this area. They have family here, and they want to be able to stay here. And the ability to support that is really great. I mean, certainly remote based options have totally expanded the pool and have removed some of the geographic barriers to things. But in also doing that, there's a lot more competition for areas when you're entirely remote. So what we see is the students are also interested in founding their own game companies. A lot of times what you'll have is people who will band together and they will be trying to create their own studio, create their own products, and model some of those things. And they're able to gain experience that way as well.
Tim, I wanted to ask about variety in the industry. Some of my favorite computer games are designed literally by one person. Some have casts that are longer than the average Hollywood movie. Is there room for a lot of different sizes of video game business in the Wisconsin scene?
Oh, absolutely. If you look at the industry as a whole, you see independent games that have maybe 3-4 people working on them, which are smaller games that can come out with a group. But the larger AAA games, the kinds you see in the news or you see advertised highly, teams are as big as 2,000 people working on a game these days. Games are very complicated to make. There's a lot of moving parts and a lot of staff that have to make them. And a lot of the AAA major titles are made in a process that's called distributed development, where you have teams all around the world collaborating on one project. We recently worked on a game called Tiny Tina's Wonderlands, and the credits alone for that game are 35 minutes long if you just let them play out. It's the number of people who worked on that game is staggering. And if you look at any of the major titles, it's very similar.
Andrew, I wanted to ask about infrastructure. You know, we've talked a lot on this show about access to broadband here in Wisconsin. Some places have it just fine. There are gaps, sometimes even closer to places like Madison that people might expect. How important a part of the equation is that, do you think?
Oh, I mean, that's absolutely essential because there are so many, just the nature of uploading and pulling the amount of data that's necessary, and making sure that you have a high quality connection is a really essential component of everything. I work with a educational game company as an art director and environment artist, and we are entirely remote with that. And we have people distributed all around the world. And I can't imagine being able to do anything remotely like that efficiently, even without having a really good firm infrastructure.
Tim,
I would like to add to that. Yeah. I just wanted to say, you know, from my company, for instance, because we're fully remote, it is absolutely critical. We have 70 employees here in Wisconsin right now, and a lot of them are in rural areas, but they have to be rural areas where they have access to high-speed internet. So if they have access to high-speed internet, a remote company like ours has the ability to employ those people.
And maybe another thing to add on to that, too, is a number of the tools that are associated with game development require online license verification. And so in a lot of ways, it's an expected part, an absolutely foundational component of just being able to use and boot up the software to do the 3D modeling, to work with the code, and then to share that. Because as Tim has referred to, it's an incredibly interdisciplinary group, and you need to be really well organized, and you have to have good file management, and that also tracks with having good access to large repositories that any one individual isn't likely going to have.
And Tim, bringing things back to this proposed legislation, do you think some of your remote employees elsewhere in the country, with a little nudge from tax policy here in Wisconsin, might be persuaded to move here in Wisconsin and pay income tax in Wisconsin and spend money in Wisconsin?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what it does for us as a company is we would be able to convince people to come to Wisconsin. We would actually take some of that incentive and push it back to the employee to give them incentive to move here. The other thing it does is it frees up capital for us to do more cooperation. I mentioned Canada earlier. When they put in those tax breaks, it allowed the industry more room to work with local educational groups, fund interesting educational incentives, and really grow the ancillary industry that grows around games. And it's very different than something like a movie credit where people come in, just spend a little money for a few weeks and are gone. Our industry, you know, when we move people in, they're here to stay and they become part of the community. It's not just the person, it's their entire family that moves with them, that becomes part of the community. And so it increases the tax base, not just for them, but for the people they bring with them.
Thanks to both of our guests today. Tim Gerritsen is Chief Operations Officer for Lost Boys Interactive, a video game development studio based in Madison. Andrew Williams is an Associate Professor of Art and Design History at UW-Stout, where he researches interactive media and digital games. With us today to talk about the growth of the video game industry in Wisconsin and a bill in the state legislature aimed at boosting that. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, AI-generated ads and calls are already a concern in the 2024 election campaign. We'll check out a proposed Wisconsin law on the issue and dig into wider worries around the country and around the world. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time.